This is an RSA podcast. RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
My guest today is one of America's most celebrated graphic designers. Ivan Shermayev helped to define the creation of modern-day corporate identity. His marks for Chase Manhattan Bank, NBC Television, and the petroleum giant Mobil are all examples of the stripped-down simplicity that Shermayev has made his own. This same economy is evident in the many illustrations and collages that have graced the posters he has produced for PBS television. And one of his most iconic works sits on the sidewalk of West 57th Street, New York. It is a giant three-dimensional number 9 and has become one of the city's landmarks. Now in his late 70s, he still runs his own design firm, Shermayev & Geismayer, which is now 50 years old. I spoke to him at the RSA in London.
Well, Ivan, welcome to this broadcast. I wanted to start by telling our listeners something that they might not know, and that's the fact that you were, although you're very much based in New York, you were actually born here of an English mother and a very distinguished Russian father, Serge Shermayev, who, along with Eric Mendelssohn, was a key architect in the modernist movement and responsible for a number of buildings, including the now grade one listed building, the Delaware Pavilion at Bexhill-on-Sea. Firstly, I wanted to ask you, do you have any recall of those early years in the UK? You were a very small child.
Well, yes, I do. They're, of course, a little sketchy and probably distorted by wishful thinking or something, but having been born in 1932, we didn't leave until the beginning of the war in 1940, so between 4 and 8 I can remember quite a bit. And we had a very nice house in Sussex, which my father designed, and I remember that quite well. And so what I don't remember is any friends from school. Because I moved around a lot.
Ah, okay.
And continued to move around when. So those early years in those terms, unfortunately, there's it's very very sketchy indeed.
But I guess you know, that the atmosphere was a very, very creative sort of climate, and so did that encourage you from a very early age to express yourself creatively? Did you find that was...
My father was very self-made. I mean, he was a very good architect and I think a brilliant teacher who never studied architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he taught himself,
yeah.
Which meant, as far as his sons are concerned, my brother Peter, who is an architect, we were both very encouraged about everything that from job. He kept every scrap of paper that we did, you know, and he'd file them away. And he was a rather gruff character. My father, and some found him very, very difficult. He was very articulate. He was a Russian who was sent to school here, but in truth, he spoke better English than most English, only because his vocabulary was greater, and he spoke all languages: French, German, English, everything. Pretty well indeed. And his Russian was impeccable. So he was very creative and encouraged us to be very creative. And no matter what Peter and I did, we were made to feel it was very exciting and good, and we should do more of it, and so on. And I think I give my father all the credit for letting us grow and have. A non supposedly proper answers to whatever we were thinking. And that's what good design is all about, is not doing exactly what you're told.
Absolutely.
Either in your own mind or by clients.
So you then obviously up sticks and went across to America, and you later had, it seemed to me, to have a very good and wide education, and design education in particular.
Yes.
So the latter part of that, tell me about the latter part of that, because I think probably around about that time, towards the end, you were meeting up with various other creative spirits that you made connection with. So just tell me a little bit about the last part of your design education before embarking on the outside world.
Well, when I was at Andover, I was the president of the arts club and that kind of thing, and which probably meant that there were two or three other members. That's about it. But I, but it was enough to know that when I went to Harvard, and Harvard didn't know anything about design. There was no Carpenter Center then. It followed very shortly thereafter, but it was nothing like that there. They had no idea about design education. So I determined that I had to move on, and instead of finishing at Harvard, I went to the Institute of Design in Chicago, where there were a lot of very good students, mostly older than myself, and a few very good instructors. And then I got a fellowship to Yale, so I Mohawk Paper Company sent me to Yale, so I went to Yale and ended up there. And from then on, I recovered from my education. It took about 6 years, I think.
What do you mean by that?
Well, none of them really knew what design was all about.
Yeah.
Design was, at that time, which was more than 50 years ago, 56 years ago, something like that. What design is, as we would envision it today, was not really very clearly understood or taught. And there were a few great practitioners. Between schools, I went to work for a well-known American designer, Alvin Lustig.
Yes, was he at CBS? Was that?
No, that's Golden.
That's
Winnie
later.
Golden.
Yes.
Alvin Lustig had his own firm, and I was his assistant. There were only three assistants. And he was an extremely intelligent, knowledgeable designer. In fact, his whole, to be rude, and he's been dead so long I can be honest about him, his sense of typography all came from Gordon Cullen here, and which nobody else knew except him and me later.
Yeah.
had a certain sense of typography that's interesting.
I always find those discoveries very rewarding because, you know, often the great heroes, one's heroes or people that one admires, you often think they're so unique, and then when you start to delve into the history of design, you discover all the points of reference, and it's sort of makes a great connection, I think, this connection of passing something on, being inspired, and then making your own. I think that's always
a way. Alvin Lustig stole it, and that's not a dishonest word to use or exaggerated word. So he took a great deal from Gordon Cullen and from Frank Lloyd Wright, which is nothing like it.
No.
And Frank Lloyd Wright was very decorative kinds of graphic that came out in his architecture and in other ways. So I worked with him before I went to Yale for some months.
Yeah.
From Chicago, I went and worked with him for 3-4 months, and then I got this fellowship, and then I went back to work for Alvin Lustig when I got out of Yale. by which time he became blind.
Oh.
Alvin Lustig continued his office blind, 100% blind.
Wow.
And the interesting thing is that he was a better designer blind than when he could see, because he was running on his theories anyway, and he was extremely intelligent. And he would sit there and sort of in his mind, you could see him scanning a book jacket.
Yes.
And going down from yes. top to the bottom yes. and telling you what the typeface was and so on. Being a diabetic, he was colorblind in the first place when he could see.
Right.
So
it's really
so it was and it all made a great deal of sense
yes.
within the vocabulary of what he had as a designer, and after a while, as a matter of being humanistic about it, one would say yes, sir, Alvin, that's great. I understand exactly what you're saying, and then you would do. Adjust it and do it and not talk about it and just do
yeah.
the job in the spirit of what he had in mind.
It's quite interesting what you're saying there, because I think what it demonstrates is, particularly within graphic design, which there's always, in my view, been two camps. There's been the, if you like, the ideas-based camp, and then there's the pure style camp. And for me, I think that the important thing to be completely successful is to have a foot in both camps, because I think you've got to be aware of style, but the principle behind any good piece of design is an idea. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying there with him is that because he was obviously rather a thinking man, an intellectual, he used his ideas, and then they could be, if you like, interpreted, those ideas, in perhaps the style of the period, or with your sensibilities as a young designer to make them, make those ideas shine. And I think that all of the great work, when you go back, seems to transcend time. It either works as an idea or it doesn't. Many of the style-based pieces of design are just that. They're moments in time and they're stunned. There's nothing else. It's like we're on a nice ice cream sundae. It looks good. A couple of bites of it, and you think, no, I there's nothing here. So you then, after leaving your education, you had a short period at CBS. Is that right?
No, I never worked.
Or was it Columbia?
No, I didn't. I was at Columbia Records.
That's it.
It's true. Yeah. CBS, and they owned
yeah.
it, but it had nothing to do with television.
No, I meant album. The reason I asked is because I think that there are two things that many, many graphic designers seem to... It's a sort of staple diet early on in their life, and that is not so much now, then certainly album covers
yes.
and book covers.
And album covers were
at least
12 inches square.
Yeah, and you had a bit of a canvas to work on.
It was a great tapestry, and that was a very fast-paced learning process, because one of the things that was required, and there were only a couple of us working for designer who was in charge, whose name was Sadamitsu Neo Fujita.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Who was no designer at all. I mean, he was a complete con artist of sorts, And I never learned anything whatsoever from him. There was nothing to learn from him, simply
yeah.
except how to deal with people upstairs,
yeah.
which he was very good at. But anyway... The point was that one was doing folders and promotion for low end records and middle, not just the important things. And it came at such a pace that one would receive a manuscript of the back copy.
Yeah.
And just take a look at it, take a look at the problem, and write down the type, the setting, the letting, and so on. Just write it on the piece and go on, and adjust slightly with the margins when it came back.
It's a fantastic discipline as well.
I learned how to spec type by instinctively saying, okay, that's going to fit at 10 point.
Yeah.
You know, and do it.
Yeah.
You know. Because there were 20, 30 things a day.
Sure.
You know, going on. And in terms of, you know, the excellence of graphic design, maybe there were two or three things that I could retain and say, gee, that's nice, I'll keep that in my portfolio.
Yeah.
But I got the job done
and
I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And every once in a while there was an opportunity to really make a nice album cover and so on.
And you were also doing book covers as well, I mean, at the right time.
Well, that was the room too.
Even now some of those covers still work fantastically well.
Well, yeah, and there were some very good art directors in certain positions, like Harry Ford was I've forgotten now where he was.
Is that what they
Simon and Schuster or somewhere?
Yes, yes.
I'm not, probably got that wrong, but there were there were a few people that supported putting nice jackets on books, and it was an opportunity, and a hard way to put bread on the table.
Absolutely, and still, for any designer, it's usually the training ground, and many, many, many distinguished designers and artists too.
And when having had a lot of contacts, when we started, I started with Robert Brownjohn, and we started an office together. We used to do record album covers because of the connection, but we do 10 at a time.
Yeah.
You know, and we would pay almost nothing for them, but if you do 10 at a time and
you can
know
make
how
a bit
to
of
work
money.
Fast, you,
yeah.
you can pay the rent more or less.
I think actually, interesting, there's a parallel here because many years ago when I interviewed Alan Fletcher, when they started their firm here, which is, I think... About the same time, maybe a little later, there would be the three of them, there would be Alan and Colin Forbes and Bob Gill arguing over who was going to do the Penguin book cover for, you know, whatever it was, £15, you know, pay their mortgages. And they found the same thing, that you do them en masse, and your thinking is concise.
And you learn how to work very efficiently.
So you've just touched on...
Because Robert Brownjohn, he was really a mixture of, not an architect exactly, but a product designer, graphic designer and so on. But he was so smart. He was just so quick about things, and had truly had an original mind, and he was very funny also, which is also helpful, so we got a lot done. The difficulty was, BJ was a heroin addict, and that is impossible to be partners with a heroin addict because. Reliability goes out the window and never to be seen again. So
if we just backtrack a moment, so you met up with Robert Brownjohn, and did you have a loose sort of partnership with him? And was Tom involved? Tom Geiser?
No, it wasn't loose. Peach and I were working fully together for a while until Tom was in the Army.
Right,
we went to Yale together.
Yeah.
We knew he was going to be to join us, but there was a period before Tom came out of the service, and then there were the three of us.
Yeah, and that early relationship with the three of you, how long did that actually last before Brownjohn left?
Well, Brownjohn left about 4 years.
Yeah, and he came here, of course,
and he came here. where Britain had a much more liberal point of view about heroin than other problems of that sort.
Of course.
And that NBJ became, I think, quite famous here for outrageous, very direct thinking.
I think it was at that period here where the, I think, in terms of graphic design, there was this change from, you know, 1950s sort of post-war mentality where the graphic design approach was not really dissimilar to what was going on before the war. Then suddenly younger designers started to, you know, adopt the modernist style and the Swiss style particularly. And it was very grid-orientated and clever. But I think then the Americans, you know, the people like Bob Gill and, and Brown John came over and really introduced, in my view, a kind of a wit and humour, which Swiss graphic design does not have. There's no humour in Swiss graphic design. It's beautiful, but there's no humour, there's no laugh.
Right.
And I think the New York school of thinking, which is, you know, witty, funny, copy-based, you know, good, witty copy, and I'm thinking about the, you know, the great copywriters over there, I think had a profound effect on those early groups. And I think that's why Brown John made such an impact, because he moved effortlessly from, you know, design to advertising here, and then into moving image, as I'm sure you were. But anyway, we're not talking about him, but he does have, obviously, a real connection. And there's something else I want to come on to later about that very thing. But then the firm seemed to be, I know it's 50 years old this year, but the beginnings were slightly fragmented. Was it a continuous 50 years, or did you have gaps where you went off and you've been going?
No, absolutely continuous.
Because you taught for a while, didn't you? You did a little bit of teaching.
Sporadically, it didn't interfere with the office.
So how did that?
I taught at the School of Visual Arts.
That's right.
I taught at, I went off to St. Louis. I went. I took a UCLA. Along the way, I've taught at various places. I've given lectures and students, and I taught at the School of Visual Arts for quite some time.
Yes. So and
it worked. In fact, actually, interestingly enough, just in the very beginning of that, I invented something. I give myself credit for inventing it anyway. I hope not inaccurately, but as a protective device, I talked Silas Rhodes, who was the head of the School of Visual Arts, who founded it, to allow two teachers, and then doubling up the amount number of students if to cover the minimal cost that we were paid anyway. But two teachers, when the work is not done in the classroom but outside the classroom, makes for a triangle of conversation, which is much richer because you can talk to the other partner that you're teaching with and disagree with or agree with, and the students, and you, and then you. You know, when you have a trialogue, it's a much, much richer way of seeing what the possibilities of what students are up to, where they could be going, where it was wrong, where it was right. And it worked extremely well. And I started doing that with Bob Gill.
Yep.
I would talk with Bob Gill. And with an American designer of the same age as myself, about Tony Palladino, was here for a short while as well.
Yes, I remember him. His name well. He also did book covers, strangely enough.
Yeah. Well, Tony's a very original, excellent designer.
Yeah. So those early days that. At the firm,
and there were very few of us.
Yes, you were sort of in a small studio with a few assistants, and it gradually evolved.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about the evolution of the company.
Well, exactly. We started out by doing the stationery and the dentity for the baby doctor, the dentist, the butcher, the banker, anybody that we had to, the landlords, we would sort of anything but to give them cash.
Yeah. That was a bartering sort of system.
Every which way that we could. Finally, we got, when we had some work to do for the Columbia Records, because, little bits and pieces here and there, book jackets, pretty soon we moved it along so that it became enough to have some real assistance. Once you get into some projects like exhibitions, then it becomes more involving and you need a little more backup.
Yes, I mean, obviously the transition from those early small, more personal jobs to the larger exhibition projects and the corporate projects. Obviously the early impacts that you made with branding, as it's called today, but it would have been called identity or whatever you want to call it, personality of an organization.
I have a hard time now calling it branding.
It is. I agree. I think branding. I too have. I always prefer to call it personality because I think that's what you're trying to achieve through expressing an organization, a personality of the organization. Branding sounds rather severe, and I just think of cowboys. But anyway, you of course did the Chase Manhattan, which
early on, 1960.
That must have really made quite a statement and started to attract other corporate clients
did. And when we did Chase Manhattan Bank, which I'm going to mention this evening, just in passing, when we did that, we probably did 9 solutions to it quite thoroughly.
Yeah.
And if the truth be known, they all would have worked.
Yeah.
Anyone.
Yeah.
Because the idea was that they were going to change the name of their bank from the Chase Manhattan Bank, which is a long thing, to Chase Bank.
Yeah.
The fact is they didn't do it for 17 years, but at the time they thought they would do it in 2 or 3.
Yeah.
So the idea of an abstract mark we developed to make that bridge, so that connect and to make the bridge to other languages and other places in the world, became a very sensible thing to do. And at that time, 1960, there were no abstract marks, except in Japan, and a history of that kind of thing. There was the Red Cross and about a handful of other things that you would call very reasonably abstract. When we presented that, it was very interesting too, because of the way big banks are structured. Everybody is a vice president, and there are hundreds of them. But we had access to the David Rockefeller, John McCloy, and George Champion there were at the top of the bank. And David Rockefeller being involved with the Museum of Modern Art, which I was always involved with the art and museum as well. That's probably how we got to doing it. David Rockefeller was given the job of deciding it, so the whole idea of doing an abstract mark, which was relatively brave and refreshing on their heart.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, it's lasted a long time. It's still there. Mm-hmm. They're ruining it because they're making it commercial looking, and it's become horrifying to see what they've managed to do.
Well, a little later, of course, you went on, and another very distinguished mark is the NBC
yes.
mark, which I think is still very much...
That's very much in place.
In place. Yes.
Even though one might, if we'd started with it, with the assignment, I'm not sure that we'd pick a mean bird like that. But, a complicated bird. But it, we, what we did was... with a very enlightened client, his name was Graham Tinker, to simplify it. And first of all, when we started, there was no NBC. There was an N. Can you believe it? NBC it reduced itself to an N, which they then put this squashed fly of a bird next to it. And the N was very it was already done by some television company in Nebraska, and for Nebraska, and as it cost NBC a fortune because they had to supply all the equipment for that place in order to not be sued any further.
Oh, really?
So we added NBC, yeah. And we took an 11-feathered bird and reduced it to 6, and it was all in the introduction of color television.
Yes.
And probably the man in the street wouldn't have known that it went from 11 to 6, and it sort of morphed into existence without notice.
Yeah. You there's another,
and it's been in place ever since.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they have a lot of people working on it.
Yes,
it's a big staff, and for a while we were involved in, you know, consulting and helping, but.
Because I think there was a kind of rivalry.
It got off to a good start.
There was a sort of rivalry at the time between NBC and CBS. CBS,
yes.
2, I think, with Lynn,
right.
Dorfman was doing,
yes.
fantastic
was
work.
Brilliant.
And it was a great, rich period for television,
yes. Yes.
Graphics and, right. Support material and so forth, posters and all those lovely things that they used to send out,
right.
That I'm sure they don't send out anymore. They, none of them have any money anymore. They're all sort of in fierce competition with all the digital channels. Another iconic project that you're involved with is the Super Graphics, and Number 9, which I think has become part of New York, really,
mm-hmm.
on West 57th Street. That was quite a brave thing, and I think a little later, or maybe before, you did a huge totem for Mobile, the series of circles that created a lot,
yes,
of sculpture.
Well, I did a lot of we did a lot of work for Mobile because they're so vast, and when we did Mobile, which is 1963,
yeah,
and there are 27,000 stations domestically,
yeah,
and double that in the world, probably, yeah. Some number like that, 50,000 places.
Yeah.
A lot of advertising.
Yeah.
At the beginning, they were in the newspaper every day, on television, I think they were supporting news programs every evening. If you're a business person, it was impossible to go through a day
without
being ill in bed and to see Mobile or Chase.
Yeah.
You couldn't avoid it. So
tell me about the Number 9 first.
The 9 developed because it was an interesting job. The owner of the building asked me to do, because he was involved with Skidmoorings and Merrill.
Yep.
We did all the work for Skidmoorings and Merrill for Gordon Bunchaff, the architect. He got us involved when there was a little number or name to put on the building. If it was appropriate, we would do that. So we worked for Skidmoor for years,
yep.
to help them out. It was very simple stuff, basically wayfinding and building identity. It's not a big deal.
Mm.
He was the one that introduced me to Sheldon Solo, who owns 9 West 57th Street. And it was very interesting because You know, I did. He was in the Seagram's building before that. Mm-hmm. That's where his office was. And I made an arrangement with his secretary. I had to wait till it was a rainy day so that his windows were be black. And I had done 9 with the idea that it fell down the slope of 9 West 57th Street and landed on the sidewalk, as opposed to just being written on the travertine.
Yeah.
And it was... I had little people, much more work than the 9, little people carrying umbrellas in the rain, and the little model of the 9, and I turned the whole thing into an event behind his door when he came back from lunch, and he couldn't resist it, but it cost him a fortune, because the 9 is supported by steel that goes through 3 floors below it.
Really?
Wow. To take the weight, and it's on city property and not his. It's beyond the building line.
Right.
And to this day, he pays rent for the space to the city for the space of the 9.
Well, that's an interesting
idea. And he's a cheapskate.
But he's got so much publicity out of that.
Yeah. He puts it on all whenever he decides to promote something. He made use of it, and we've become great friends and everything else. And it's, I don't know how many years have gone by since that.
Well, it's a long time.
18
it's
years,
still,
something like that.
I mean, it is one of those beautiful pieces of work.
Yeah, I think it's about, and it doesn't matter that it reads backwards if you're coming from the west side, you know, or it reads properly from Fifth Avenue.
I want to just go back to Mobile now, because it would seem to me that with Mobile in particular and their sponsorship activities for PBS television,
yes,
that was where I think, looking at the body of work that was produced, and I know there were many, many other designers involved as well over a long period of time, but I think your work in particular really demonstrates your own very personal, you know, take on graphic design, not only in the pure graphic aspect, but also as an illustrator, which I think, you know, you have an effortless approach to illustration, which, and your use of handwriting as well, which is very, very much your signature, literally.
Thank you for noticing that.
Well, it's
I enjoy it. I also.
And I'm looking at all those posters as I have done. I have the various books that were published, the one in Mobile posters, and reviewing them over the last week or so prior to meeting you. You know, it's a treasure trove of wonderful posters. It would seem to me that it, you know, looking at it as a graphic designer myself, something you put a lot of effort into. That it seemed that, you know, you get those occasional dream jobs where the client is perfect and you're allowed to do what you like, and in those circumstances you really give your all, because you haven't got someone in the background saying, oh, I don't think we can do that. So I think it demonstrates a wonderful body of work. Can you tell me a little bit about that, how you approached them? Because I know that you were, I think you're also commissioning as well for them, possibly.
Well, having with Mobile supporting Mobile Showcase, Mobile Masterpiece Theater, a tremendous amount of support. Herb Schmertz, who was the he wasn't the art director exactly. He was on the board of Mobile, but he was in charge of their promotion and all that kind of stuff. And he was very supportive and essentially allowed us to do whatever we wanted, which is mostly me. This sort of open view of bus shelters, which is where the posters mostly appeared as a good media in New York. They're right there in your face, and it was very much left alone to do it. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy this program. We're going to buy this series. And they bought a tremendous amount from here. From England, BBC, and other things as well, I think, programs. And when you have an ongoing assignment, which leaves you free to do whatever you think is right. I mean, you have to follow some rules about contracting things, that if there are stars involved and so on, you have to respect some of that, obviously. But otherwise, when you have a free hand, I've always found that you work harder.
Yeah.
It's somehow or another. It's not. It sounds easier, but it's not. It's actually harder.
I think because you become the client.
Yes.
And you're the hardest client.
You have to think it out more. You have to do more digging and more research. Sometimes, the enjoyment of it is greater. There are no meetings. There's nothing there. And if it's going to continue, you'll have to do a good job.
Yeah.
It has to be good, because that's going to get you another one.
Yeah.
And ongoing. Otherwise, the discussion comes to an end, and you find other people sneaking in to do what you enjoy most, which they do anyway, because there's so much of it. But I had more than a normal amount of shares.
You certainly did.
And that was great.
And you were able to demonstrate.
A year.
Yeah, and you were really able to demonstrate the kind of vocabulary of your approach, both in, you know, pure stripped back graphic ideas through to some really large collage pieces as well. I think for PBS also, you did some for the Metropolitan Transport System.
MTA, yes.
MTA, yeah, mm-hmm. The large, very large,
yes,
beautiful
yes. Mm-hmm.
series of mm-hmm. posters, mm-hmm. which I...
Which were cultural events, keeping museums open at night one evening and that kind of thing. And all of the institutions, from big ones like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but the smaller museums and so on as well, and that was supported by mobile.
Yeah. Does that continue to this day, or is that a long gone?
No,
you don't work for
them
much anymore.
Well, first of all, mobile was bought by Exxon.
Yeah.
And their cultural shock was so severe that when that happened, we were consultants to mobile for 38 years.
Wow.
That's a long
time. Yes.
When Exxon took them over, they didn't even ask us any questions on the telephone. All the consultants gone.
Yeah.
They don't care about anything except money. They don't care about cultural affairs.
No.
To this day, it's now quite a few years have passed.
I go
and have lunch with the chairman of Mobile, who's retired, because they have their laws, and he's, high 70s, 80 in age, older than I am, we got tremendous support from, and that was Raleigh Warner, who was chairman for 11 years, and totally interested in design because it was so different from his world, and he enjoyed it.
I think
understanding it and seeing that how it added to his world.
It's a hard-nosed,
sophisticated,
but it's hard-nosed, and I think to to use. I mean, if I think it happens, it's a rare occurrence. But when it does happen, it's highly beneficial for the companies and the perception
Absolutely.
Of those companies. And I think that you know, whilst clearly it doesn't happen anymore with that client, all of that work is kind of frozen. It's a moment in time. And when you look back, and I think of all the posters by Paul Davis as well.
Yes, right.
I see stuff by Derek Birdsall.
Yes, and even in that, but I had enough to do that I would hire illustrators, usually, because it was just clear that the subject matter was not something that I was comfortable with, and I realized that Jim McMullen or Paul Davis or somebody else would be able to do a much better job.
Yeah.
But instead of giving them the job, I would give them the task, and I would still deal with the typography and put it together and get the job done.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're 50 years old this year, the firm. I would think that you can probably remember back to those early days just like that. These time seems to go so horribly quickly.
Yes, unfortunately it does.
It really does. So what is the size of the firm today, and how has it changed since then?
It's changed quite a bit, because we built up to 30 people on staff, but maybe a little more, 35.
Yeah.
As time has gone by over these years, you can get now the other help that you need in a matter of moments. They're all around you.
Yeah.
You can pick up the phone, you have a network of people who can come over and give you a hand if you need more drafting or more follow-through. You can get it very quickly. So there's no reason to have an enormous staff.
No.
But we had still the staff. Because of exhibitions, they take hands, and so we built that up to that scale until about 2.5 years ago. I'm 75. Thomas the same age. So we were at Yale together, and concluded that what we had done was to build a bureaucracy of our own making, and what the hell for. So you end up spending a tremendous amount of time in meetings, exhibits, and wayfinding, working with architects, is not very creative. I'd say it's 5-10% tops.
Yeah.
And the rest is slogging and getting it done, checking it out, and working with because the projects are big, you end up sort of looking after it, which means meetings or talking to contractors or following through. And who needs it?
And I guess worrying about the overhead and the staff's mortgages and all that stuff.
It was silly. So we were in a situation where our office, the building, was turning into condominiums because that's where the money was, and you know, real estate is an insane world. And so we had to move anyway. So we said, "Well, we got to move. What do we need to? Why don't we rethink this whole thing, and do what we really love?"
Yeah.
Tom and I decided, "Well, what the hell?" So we took the best people in our office, just a handful.
Yeah.
So we had 2 or 3 people of real talent who were really great, and we decided that if we stay with what we really do best, that's all we need for people, because you can get anybody else if you want to do something more complicated in no time. In a day you can work it out with other offices, or let them do the follow through work, and we do the creative work. So that's what we decided to do. So we let most of our office go off on their own, and And they're perfectly successful, and they do that kind of work that we don't like to do.
Yeah. And so, what's your daily routine now then?
We work with a few clients who are very appreciative of what we do. We work all over the world. It's much more fun. I mean, I do personally. I've been working in Turkey since 1971. I've done maybe 18 companies there, and they're all the biggest companies in Turkey.
Wow.
The difference is that you're treated like a doctor.
Yes.
If they don't, you say, I think we should make this yellow, and you come to that conclusion because of the competition, and blah, 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 blah. They wince and they do it because you're the doctor.
Yeah. And that's refreshing.
And I don't mean to exaggerate that you're doing things they don't want, because mostly they're very appreciative,
yeah,
extremely loyal,
yeah,
and that's it. And so it goes on.
And of course,
major companies, they're all very big.
And in fact, it was very nice last
and
year.
And it's in Turkish, so nobody sees it unless you go to Turkey.
But I was very, very pleased to see a whole range of your illustration work here last year for Mothercare, which suddenly appeared on the scene. And I thought, I know that hand. And sure enough, it was your work, which is lovely. And it takes me on to, I think, the other area that you have been involved with over the years, and that's children's books, which you...
Yeah, I haven't done them in a long time.
But they're still in print. A lot of them still seem to be in print.
They're in print, and they're around, and would be happy to do them more. But I've been making a lot of collages.
Mm.
On my own.
Yeah.
I'm going to show some this evening.
Oh, good.
Just a handful, just because they're... I enjoy doing them. I've been doing them all my life,
yeah,
and so on. I get something from them for my real work. I call it the real work.
Yeah.
Because my collages are making visual connections where connections weren't required to even be thought of. An example would be my son, who's 26, is an architect in Japan. When he was younger, I had him making handprints and footprints of little hands and feet and so on in the ink and then all over the paper, and he made all this stuff for me, which I have drawers full of. but it's very nice, because if you put a foot in the middle, it's a nose,
yeah,
not a foot.
Yeah.
Or you put it here, it's a mouth.
Yeah.
And you know, two of them are eyes.
Yeah.
And so I have all kinds of stuff, and that's how I make collages, say, you know, that this can fit here, and this can make that, and all of a sudden these things come together and make visual connections of some sort or another. And because of Turkey, we had two major exhibits there, a whole floor of a museum of my collages,
yes,
last year, and another floor which was our posters and graphic stuff for Turkey and for the world.
And that's very much a personal thing, as I can
yes,
see. It's something you've been doing for them, but it informs
but it,
everything
but
else.
But it enriches everything
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I wanted to just, finish on another little book that was published a couple of years ago, 2006, but in fact the text was written in 1959.
Well, no, not the text. The whole
the whole thing
was done. It's a scale changed slightly.
Yeah.
We did it as a little thing for Type House, and then in a matter of days,
yeah,
we did the whole thing.
I should just describe for listeners that this is a book called Watching Words Move, And it's really extremely simple. It's just literally one typeface in black, all reversed out white, and it is really puns on words, actually physically breaking them up to express what those words are saying. And the reason I wanted to talk about it was that this very project is almost identical to the one that Robert Brownjohn became very famous for here, which is the Midland Bank ads, which, you know, for years and years and years, I think so nobody knew.
Well, he came from
I know, of course
did this
he did.
Together.
Of course he did. And I think that the point I wanted to make is that I think for many, many years, nobody realized the origin of this work. And I think this book sort of sets the record straight, that this collective idea of taking words and animating them and expressing
and
them.
The three
expressing,
of us and the three really, of you did, really did it. That together.
And it's still, I mean, terrifically fun and fresh. And I think it... I've seen this, you know, this has become sort of, it's become part of the folklore of graphic design. Everyone, you know, if they have anything about them, whenever they're beginning to design anything and you're looking at a word, look at the word to find something in it before you do anything else. And this is a great little primer for that kind of thinking. And it's lovely to see it back
in
print.
Well, a lot of people have stolen the... from it,
yeah.
That's for sure. Which is nice.
Of course, it is.
I really don't mind it. It's all right.
When you're—I mean, this might be a very stupid question—but when you're not designing, what sort of things do you enjoy doing?
I make collages and assemblages of one sort or another. Travel.
Yeah.
Gardening.
Yeah.
Being
which is another form of design, actually, isn't it?
Yes.
Gardening,
yes.
Really.
My wife and I had a barn, 1863 barn, an hour from New York in the North Salem, and enjoyed very much being out in the country and walking in the canyon.
Yeah. There are probably young, hopeful graphic designers listening to this program. And we now live in a vastly different age from when you started, where everything was pasted up and you got typesetting, and you know, there was typeset metal. Now everything is down the line, it's put together, but it doesn't change the thinking. Have you got any kind of pearls of wisdom that you would like to pass on to any young designer listening?
Well, it's only... hard work is necessary, but we all have these tools. None of us could survive without them. Computers and so on. Personally, I never touch buttons, and I don't have a cell phone. And I find the computers are very slow, because thinking is what it's all about, and they are tools, and that's all. And what I know how to do is talk to assistants and so on who can follow through. I also think that computers have lowered the quality of graphic design considerably, because programs that clients can buy and so on reduce the exploratory high level that graphic design can reach.
Yeah.
Have lowered it. I also believe that it will rise again, and because it gets better and better. But it takes time when you have bad habits, and rely on things. To get beyond that, to be new and exciting and refreshing again, takes time. My own guess is that it takes 15 or 20 years to reach the highest levels of exploration and newness.
Yes.
It takes that long. I haven't got that long. So in that sense, I find that computers are not very helpful.
Mm.
And also the other reason that I don't personally use it directly, my office does, my work does, it's all in the work, but I don't want to be the slowest, most incompetent person in the office. Which I would be if I touched any buttons.
Well, I'm sure you don't need to, because the work you produce by hand is still very beautiful.
Well, I like scissors, and I use them.
They're a good bit of technology.
They're very fast.
And you don't have to plug them in.
No. Use my way of working, and then have somebody else transfer it, and I'm very good at correcting and saying move this, move that, that, and it's a little bit like a computer is my being behind somebody who is actually on the computer. It's really the same thing, but I find it more efficient. And the other thing is, I should say, as a working thing, that nowadays the complexity of graphic design is such that being cooperatively minded is very helpful to getting good work done. It is to understand where other people are coming from and how good they are, and what they have to offer that you don't have.
Yes.
You know, that when you allow interruption and criticism or sharing of ideas and so on, we have an office of 10, and it's completely open. The secretary can say something if she wants to. They don't usually, but sometimes they do, because they come from another end. But knowing that they don't have to be embarrassed means that occasionally they say, you know, I saw that something, and you don't want it to have it look like some chocolate company downtown.
Yeah.
Because it's very hard to design symbols and trademarks in a world in which there are millions.
Yes.
And to be new and refreshing. So we keep it very open as a way of working, and anybody can say anything to anybody else while we're doing it, and it's extremely efficient way to do it. It is to remove ego,
yes,
as much as possible.
Yes,
and that is my recommendation to young people: is to be open
to
others, but you have to be selective about that.
Yes.
Just because somebody says something doesn't mean it's sensible or you should listen.
Sure.
But finding people who have things to say that are worth listening to is a very good way of thinking about design.
Well, I think that's to be open, I think it's a very good note to end on. Ivan Shomayev, thank you very much.
RDI Insights. Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.